Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
RANs, welcome back to another episode of Horror Joy Meet Your Maker. Today, we are joined by author Kaylee Scholes. Kaylee Scholes is a horror author living and writing in the wilds of Florida. She's the author of Saint Grit, Black Rain Season, and the forthcoming on November 5th, Yeehaw Junction, and various short stories. She'd love to hear from you at her email address, kayleescholes@gmail.com, or the contact page here on her website, which is kayleescholes.com. So Kaylee, welcome to Horror Joy. We're going to start with our usual question. Our podcast, we are looking to investigate the intersection of joy and horror, like how, you know, Brian and I both find horror to be a very joyful genre, despite what some folks might say. So how do you see that relationship as a horror creator? What for horror is joyful for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me on. Excited to be here. Yeah, so I was thinking about this question, and I think horror and joy are, you know, inherently together for me. But I think it took some time for that. Like many of us that write and read and consume horror media, we started pretty young. We were probably too young for it. A lot of it went over our head, or it's just like thematically just too much to take in. I was one of those kids where at the age of five, I was watching Poltergeist on the TV. And, you know, I think what's interesting about that, I'm using that as an example because you see it as the kids in the film, the two kids or the three kids. And then, you know, as a kid yourself, you're seeing them haunted by these ghosts. And then you see the parents who are mirroring your own parents. They're, you know, the parents, the Craig T. Nelson character, and I forget her name, but the, you know, they're burdened by job loss and these financial problems. And you're seeing that as a kid that's like kind of mimicking your parents' own problems. And so it's like, oh, I have something to relate to outside of just my peers who maybe aren't going through the same thing I'm going through, you know? And like, I don't know, I think you see that and you relate to it. And like, there's this, the ending is so satisfying. It's like, you get to that, you cross that bridge and it's like, oh, it's a sigh of relief. We made it, we survived. And I don't know, I feel like that kind of plays into real life and how you feel like you will get there eventually. And, you know, like now I think as an adult, that's very different. I think now as an adult, horror is, of course, it's something I've grown up with, but it's like, I feel like there's this reward system almost in the brain, like just a hit with dopamine when you're consuming all of this great content that is mirroring our social issues and just everyday things. Like, you know, I'm a functional adult, but like if you're taking like your everyday life with, you know, family, friends, work, whatever, just your life problems, and you're throwing a supernatural slant into it, whether it's something, a boogeyman outside or something in the house or a weird neighbor or whatever, like that takes all the structure and just rips it right from under you, just severing it completely. And but it's fake. It's not real. And so that just, there's this like, that, like I said, like a reward to that is like, okay, it's fake. I have to see what's going to happen next, or I have to write this to see what's going to happen next. Yeah, I think too, like, I don't know. I think it makes you feel bigger than you really are, because there's often, there's justice. There's a lot of defeating of monsters and boogeymen, like I said. And I just, I don't know. It makes us curious and keeps us safe at the same time.
I was thinking a few things as you were talking. And one of them is that it feels as though part of what you're saying is there's a horror for everyone. You're a kid, you're an adult, you're a parent, it doesn't matter. There are horrors in this world, and there's horrors that kind of will align with your life no matter where you are. I think there's something to that, where you can read a story different times in your life and see it so differently because the horrors of that story just hit differently when you're an adult, when you're a kid, when you're a parent, when you're, you know, whatever you are. It kind of, there's horrors for everybody. Horror also grows with you, is what I was hearing you say, in part that, right, as you get older, as you see the world differently, not only in relation to other people, but just in terms of how politics work, how our society works, how anxieties in our life work, all of those things, it seems like it grows with you. And I really like that answer. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about your writing. This is your third book, Yeehaw Junction, coming out November 1st. How long have you been writing? Has it been something that you've just always done? You talked a little bit about this kind of satisfaction of the finishing of stories and justice and characters and coming to it, not only as a viewer, but as a writer. So what is your horror, or really, what is your writer origin story like?
Well, yeah, I've started writing about 32 years ago. I was an only child and I was pretty isolated. I grew up in the Southeast US. Writing and just writing little stories and little plays and acting out the plays by myself was just really natural to me to do. I think I had a lot inside of me that wanted to just express everything, and that was the only way I knew how to do it. You know, like I said about watching Poltergeist at 5, or like the original Universal monster films at around the same age, eventually like reading Goosebumps and that kind of stuff. Like I just wanted to emulate all of that so bad. And yeah, when I wrote my first novel, I mean, it's never seen the light of day. It was just a, you know, it's in a drawer somewhere. But I wrote my first novel one summer when I was 15. And after that, I was working a lot. I was working in warehouses, grocery stores, steel mills, just all kinds of stuff. And I decided to take my writing more seriously and to start submitting it places. And this was in the like mid-2000s at some point. And I wasn't getting anywhere with it. And I thought, and I didn't know better, but I thought to be taken seriously, I needed to quit writing horror, quit reading horror, and focus on contemporary literary type fiction. I don't know why I chose that, but I spent a decade reading and writing that stuff. I wrote a couple books and kind of used that time to really like it, just self-taught myself, you know, the discipline of writing every day, editing, revising, just everything that goes into that. And my chops got better doing that. And then I don't know what happened in 2015, I think it was, I fell back in love with the genre and I was like, what am I doing? And I love this genre. I have missed so much work from this genre, missed consuming it. What's wrong with me? And I went back to it. Yeah, I've been writing it now for a decade, short stories and novels. And I don't know, I think my skills are better than they used to be, which is good. But yeah, I just fell back in love with the genre.
Yeah, so something you're talking about there that Brian and I talk about with a lot of other creators between the two of us on the podcast as well, is how horror often gets maligned as like this genre for weirdos, or as it's not really literature, it's not really good writing, it's for freaks, it's for people that like don't like good books. Despite the fact that, I mean, we're kind of in a horror renaissance right now with like some of the books we're getting, whether it's, you know, Interrupt Dues, The Reformatory, or I mean, like there's just been so many really great books that have been produced in the past 5-10 years, let alone the movies we're getting. Like, I mean, you know, we had Sinners, we have Weapons, we have A24 has gone from a very niche studio to being some of the most anticipated films every year. Neon, similarly, right? So why is it do you think that people view horror in this way, in which like that it doesn't really get respect, and that it's kind of like the genre for weirdos, and people are like, oh, I don't do horror. Like, I mean, the amount of people that you meet and you're, I mean, I don't know, at least that I talk to and when I'm teaching, especially who you like talk about horror, they're like, no, I don't do that. As if it's like a leper or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like the tale as old as time. Like that goes back. I mean, when we were watching, you know, something like Are You Afraid of the Dark, for example, as kids, that to a lot of kids, that was super lame. Okay. It's like a bunch of different ghost stories and vampire, you know, whatever the storyline is. And it's, you know, the special effects are cheesy and whatever. And I feel like we were picked on because of, just as an example, we were picked on for liking that kind of stuff because a lot of times people want to feel above it because they don't want to be scared. And they don't allow themselves to enjoy things like that. I think there's that whole argument about like even just the Academy Awards comes up, like how often has a horror movie been nominated for best movie? So few times. And it is crazy to think about, like there's just so much good content out there, good film, good books. And yeah, it still has that reputation. It still has that reputation as just not being like, if it's not coming from like a place of about, I don't know. I guess people don't think it reflects real life, which of course it does.
I think you're right. Like, I think there's so much. I think part of what we are doing with the podcast is trying to shine a light on the way that, in fact, horror is very much about real life, right? It's about our life right now. It's simplified, it's exaggerated, it's dramatized, it's taken to extremes. But in many ways, it just circles right back to showing us exactly what is going on in our lives, what's going on in our society, what's interesting, what's terrifying, what's exciting about our culture, about all the things. Jeff, like you mentioned, sinners and the reformatory weapons, Nosferatu, all the stuff that's going on, artistic expression, I think it's important. Yeah, that we see horror as something doing good work to shine a light on what we're thinking about, what we're doing, what we should be doing, how we should be going about our lives in some way, at least in terms of understanding what the anxieties are. I want to jump into Yeehaw Junction, if that's okay with you. This was a wild one. There are some really, really cool things about this book. I'll hold it up, the cover. I remember I saw the cover posted on social media and the description, and I remember I sent a text to Jeff, and I was like, I think we got to have this on our radar because this is really cool. So thank you for sending it to us and allowing us to read it, to talk to you about it. There's lots of these kinds of stylistic things that you do, and I really love this. So a lot of the chapters, I hope this isn't a spoiler. If it is, let me know. We can cut it out or whatever. But right, it jumps back and forth between like different kinds of archival texts or media texts, you know, clippings from the newspaper or YouTube videos or something like, you know, all these different kinds of things. Sure. And I'm just curious, one, I haven't read your other work. Do you do this often in your work? And two, what draws you to including those kinds of media alongside the kind of main story that you're telling with your main characters?
In my other work, no, this was my first time doing archival insertions to the main novel. I got interested in this when I was writing a short story unrelated to Yeehaw Junction a couple years ago that was inspired by the JonBenet Ramsey case, indirectly. It was about, I had been thinking about what happens to the siblings or the neighbors and these kind of, you know, investigative situations where the whole world is kaleidoscoping in on these like horrors of, you know, something like a child abduction or a child murder, God forbid. And I was reading transcripts of one of JonBenet Ramsey's older brother that was from back in the 90s. And as a kid that grew up in the system, so to say, and having been interviewed before in that same situation, it was fascinating to me. And I thought, oh my God, I have to put that somewhere.
That's really neat to see like the way in which that media then it, you know, works in the novel too. The main character, I mean, Skeet, right? In Yeehaw Junction? Yeah. I think Skeet is interesting to me because Skeet in many ways, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but again, we can cut if need be, is repulsive, is gross, is I don't want to say evil, but like there are some things where it seems kind of evil, but he's also a reflection of everything that made him this way, right? What I enjoyed about this novel, because I thought it was hard to read, like it reminds me of Fight Club in some ways. It reminds me of some of like Trainspotting, and I'm going to forget the author's name. Doesn't matter. But some of that work from like the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, the Marilyn Manson connection probably helps with that too. But like the horror that we're getting in this novel is kind of not actively, I mean, it is actively happening at times. Don't get me wrong. But like some of it is like reflecting on like, why are these characters the way they are? And to me, like that's something that's the type of horror that Brian and I like to, you know, dive into, where we're trying to figure out, okay, like what is this a commentary on? Like, how is this making us reflect on what it means to be alive in the post-capitalist hellscape of 2025, when we've cut every social safety net, when we just have outright genationalism and borderline fascism coming from the actual like government and not just the fringes? These characters to me are perfect for the moment we're in, because they are people that so much of the population would rather just drive by and not buy the $2 jar of dirt, or however much they were charging for the jars of dirt. So like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like how, you know, am I completely off base? Like, as part of the horror here, what leads to a character like Skeet? What leads to a character like Cricket?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, I wanted to, like, you going off a little bit what you were just saying, echoing that there were, I wanted to write about the margins, the people on the margins of our society. And like a great example of this, I was living in Central Florida in the mid-2000s, around 2007, 2008, when the Casey Anthony, Kaylee Anthony media circus happened. And you could not go anywhere in Florida without seeing that little girl's face. And it was such, it took over everything. And there were legit search parties, and it was happening in our own backyard, so to say. And, you know, it was just, everybody had an opinion on it. And, you know, and there were literally, there were people selling t-shirts with this kid's face on it. And of course, it's all very backwards, and it's a very American thing to happen. And I think having seen that up close, and then the trial a few years later, and just all of it, and the way the parents and the neighbors were investigated, and the just people that had once known her. And I mean, it was horrific. And, you know, like, I think someone like Skeet, yeah, he's a reflection of everything that's happened to him. And I won't give away a spoiler, but there is, you know, something from his birth that is kind of, you know, happened that is like, oh, okay, this kid really never had a chance in hell. And, you know, people like Cricket are just like, she never had a chance. Like you get a little bit of her backstory in the book. And, you know, and Trudy, another character who Trudy definitely knows right from wrong, I think, but she doesn't care. And, you know, but looks at it under a microscope of, all this is all for, you know, the sake of justice and, or my justices. And, you know, I have every right. Look at my history. And, you know, just that kind of stuff, like how horrifying that is to be on the fringes of society when there's people around you that are flourishing or thriving in other ways. And you can't even get a hot lunch, you know, something like that.
Yeah, I've been trying to think about the way that this novel is a horror novel. And I think what you're saying there really actually helps me understand, because it's not just like you read the characters, and the characters are really difficult to sympathize with. They're difficult to empathize with. They're difficult to kind of to root for sure. The horror is not just what they do and how they act, but it is a reflection of the environment in which they're in. The hyper-capitalism that you're talking about, what are you going to do if the tragedy happens? You're going to try to make a quick buck as best you can. What are you going to do if there's radioactive material or poison in the earth? What are you going to do? You're going to put it in jars and try to sell it, right? There's something about the system, the foster care system, even just childcare generally, how it works to build an environment that is horrific, that I think is being identified here, right? There's a a highlighting of the complexities of how this kind of horror is generated. And I appreciate what you're saying there. I wanted to ask you a little bit about place. You're writing and living in Florida. Sometimes I think people outside of Florida hear things about Florida and go, is it like that? And so reading this made me even more curious. If this was, so you're writing about the people on the margins, but you're writing about a very specific place, Yeehaw Junction and other kinds of places like that. These kinds of places, again, they bottle them up in jars and try to sell them, literally trying to sell the place. How does this sense of place map onto actual Florida? And how does it kind of generate that, continuing the conversation about horror, how does it help to generate horror, the horror of place in many ways?
Yeah. Well, Yeehaw Junction today is nothing more than there's a Wawa there. Back in the 90s, it was a little more reflective of what I wrote about. But as far as like time and place, like there are a lot of, I mean, just like anywhere, but I think in Florida, you know, we're so populated and there's so much farmland here and sugarcane fields. And I just feel like there's so many little nooks and crannies of these little towns, especially in central and northern Florida, that really are just off the beaten path, feeling like they're not a part of anywhere. They're not even a part of Florida. They're surviving on their own. Like it's like a whole different world. And a lot of those people are completely forgotten. I think there was a second part to your question. Sorry.
Just how place generally works its way into your understanding of horror and how you're trying to communicate that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I love horror that takes place in the South. I love any writing that takes place in the South because it's such a rich place to write about. But I think for me, I love writing. It's so cliche to say this, but I love writing about what I know. And I have grew up in Georgia, I grew up in Alabama, I grew up in Florida. And I don't know. It's just a lot of, I just think it's actually an underwritten place. I think that there's a lot, it's all different kinds of people here. There's a lot of, we have like the cryptid stories about a skunk ape and stuff like that. That's fun. But there's just a lot of rich history down here. And a lot of horrific things happen here. You know, you combine the fiction with the facts and it's kind of fascinating.
I really appreciate your comment about like the small towns, the nooks and crannies, the ones that are off the beaten path. Cause like we're both in central Pennsylvania.
Right.
That is more or less a description of, I would argue, anywhere in rural America. Like there are plenty of places that are off the beaten path. But like you're also right. There's something very distinct about the Southeast. I lived, as listeners will know, in Alabama for about 5 years down in Mobile and got to explore some of the more rural areas around Mobile at times between like Mobile and New Orleans along the I-10 corridor there, or between Mobile and Pensacola, again, along the I-10 corridor there too. But what you're saying, a lot of these small towns that are forgotten are off the beaten path because they're off highways. And there's this great scene in the book with a highway, like where they're at the on-ramp, and I'm not going to spoil it, but like, to me, there's something that we've lost in the character of place when we just put in all these highways and how we travel on highways. And like we see highways used in horror, whether it's Final Destination or, you know, other movies like that. But there's something that even though these roads are used to connect people or get people to get from point A to point B faster, they actually disconnect large communities and isolate them and alienate them. And that seems to be a theme that is coming up in Yeehaw Junction over and over again. Alienation, like the idea that these are communities that have been left behind. These are people who have been left behind and ignored and not cared for. And so I think that's great, like from a social commentary perspective. But then like, there's almost like a revenge story happening here too.
Of look what you've done, I'm going to show you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And some of that seems to, like, I'm curious how that element of the novel then, just with the Marilyn Manson Columbine element of the novel, because like that's really neat. I love the interconnectivity there. I mean, as someone that lived through the era, I mean, I guess we're still in the era of mass school shootings, but I'm old enough to remember before that was normal. And when Columbine happened, how like we were all very shook, as the kids would say. And yet we've, you know, decided to do fuck all about it for the last three decades. So like, why bring up the specter of Columbine for a character like Skeet, who is fascinated with it?
Yeah. I think that timeline, so in the late 90s, I was 12, 13, 14 years old, around that time, like I remember that very distinctly when that happened. And I think for a lot of us millennials, that was just such a marker, the same way that like 9/11 was a marker in our lives. Like everything went, it feels like just with music and with an increase in school violence and just mass violence in general, just in our, not just, I mean, just like in the small towns of America, like that happened in, if I'm not mistaken, I don't, like Little Rock, Colorado or something. Like that was not a name until that happened. And I think for someone like Skeet, you know, when you're isolated in the middle of nowhere like that with nothing, doing fuck all, you know, he's pretty much illiterate. I think someone like Marilyn Manson, that's your whole life. Whatever you're accessing from the radio, which, you know, I mean, Marilyn Manson is, music is very benign. It doesn't, but that's besides the point. It doesn't matter to someone like Skeet, who is, you know, 12 years old, someone like that, that's like being blamed for, you know, this massacre that happened in a little town. Like it's like to him, like, oh, that's perfect. That's what I want to do. Because it's like, that's all he has is just what's right in front of him. He isn't capable of critical thinking and probably never will be if the, you know, so I think, I don't know. I think those things just, it really paints a picture of the 90s and the, just the segue into the 2000s with just violence. And then there was conversation about violence in music and violence in film. And there was Tipper Gore and all that stuff going on. Yeah.
No, I think that makes a ton of sense. And actually it clicks for me that there's really no way for Skeet to make any kind of impact on the world but through violence. So seeing something like Columbine, seeing somebody heard in Marilyn Manson, these are people that he thinks, this is the way that I can make meaning of the world and be meaningful to the world is by my violent outbursts or something like that. We're coming to the end of our time here, but Kayla, I want to ask if there is anything out there recently that you have read or watched or played, if you're a video game player or if you like tabletop games, any of that stuff in the horror genre that has caused you or generated joy for you. So anything recent in the horror genre that has generated joy, anything like that for you?
Yes. My knee-jerk reaction to this was going to be Weapons. I think it's one of the best horror movies made, but we all love Weapons. We already know that. I read a short story recently by Rath James White in the End of the World as We Know It anthology. He wrote a short story called The Trips. It is phenomenal. It is just, I love his writing. The story had me on the edge of my seat. I was genuinely disturbed. Great stuff.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing those. And yes to Weapons. It's really great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to join us.
Thank you.
Listeners, please be on the lookout for Yeehaw Junction. It hits shelves of bookstores on November 5th. You can pre-order it online. Support your local independent bookshop or use bookshop.org. Keep that money out of greasy, grimy Jeff Bezos's hands. Unless he wants to sponsor Horror Joy, and we're still looking for sponsors. I'm just kidding. We don't want his money. We'll take it from the other awful corporation, AMC, that has Nicole Kidman still held captive in an auditorium.
She's been there for a long time.
She looks good. She looks good for being trapped there. That's a nice suit she has going. Must be the popcorn. Who knows? But anyway, Kaylee, thank you again so much for the time. Listeners, you can find out more about Kaylee. Find her work at KayleeScholes.com. Pre-order Yeehaw Junction, y'all. So, Kaylee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff and Brian. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And listeners, remember, seek joy, even in horror.
This has been an episode of Horror Joy, produced in conjunction with Axis Mundi Media. Thanks for joining us. We want to hear from you. You can find us at Horror Joy Pod on Instagram or at Horror Joy Pod on YouTube. You can also email us at horrorjoypod@gmail.com, all one word. And you can, of course, find us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a like, subscribe, leave a review. Until next time, remember, seek joy, even in horror.
Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sinvergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora, who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.